till the tears run down from my eyes. Lord, somebody, ooh, somebody, can anybody find me somebody to love?
Alexa, play hits from Queen.
Okay.
With Amazon Music, a voice is all you need. Get tens of millions of songs. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resilience, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Fletcher Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so glad you're here. We have a very exciting guest today, someone calling in from overseas in the UK, Dr. Sharon McDonald, and you'll hear more about her insights on parents surviving their children's suicide as the topic of today's conversation. In preparing for this, I was really thinking about how traumatizing this particular form of grief is, and I just recently reposted a blog I wrote a number of years ago on the complexities of traumatic grief and how the efforts of what we need to do for our grief process for mourning are very much at odds, which often happens with the traumatic response. So grief is often a moving towards, a reminiscing, an honoring, a hold one's memory, and a talking about the positive stories of a person's life. And trauma is often like touch the hot stove. It's a move away. It's an avoidance. It's a fear response. And so often you'll have this push-pull sense within a person and also within a family that people are moving in and out of this traumatic grief push-pull at different times and different paces, and it can be very complicating for families. There's a book that I read way back in my graduate school years that has still stayed with me all these years, and it's by Ronnie Zanna Fulman, and it's called Shattered Assumptions Toward a New Psychology of Grief. And I think about this when I think about parents surviving the loss of their child by suicide, in that when we experience trauma, often our core beliefs are shattered. These things that we walk around with every day that help us feel safe and capable and in control of our life. Before the trauma that we experience, we often feel like the world is logical and bad things happen for a reason and there's justice in the world. And, you know, if you do the right things, everything's going to be okay. And what trauma shows us is that it's really all upended. That assumptions about the world's benevolence of people have good intentions and that we can be trusting and that we have a sense of invulnerability, all of that gets knocked on its head. And the result is that we usually have significant anxiety because the world now seems like a dangerous place. We also have assumptions about the meaningfulness of the world, that the world is just and it makes sense. And suicide often shatters that for people. And as my great colleague and mentor Frank Campbell says, we tend to fall into this canyon of why, where we're filled with self-blame and personal responsibility for the death. And sometimes other people also have this kind of make sense mandate in their head. And so they'll blame us and they'll say somehow we deserve this in their own direct and indirect ways. And that's often very hurtful. We also have assumptions that we walk around every day, many of us, with a sense of that the self is worthy, that we're capable, we're decent, we're competent. And traumas like a suicide death of a child make us often feel helpless, and we're very cognizant of our own and others' vulnerability. So parents and other relatives, but parents in particular, often have a long and complicated grief process. Where their address books change, for example. People don't know how to talk to them. People you think will show up disappear, and other times new people come into your life. And sometimes parents and other family members are at increased risk of suicide themselves after the suicide of a child or an offspring. There's a yearning to be with the person. There's a lot of survivor guilt, which I'm sure we'll talk about. There's a lot of suffering, anger at the person who died, anger at the providers, friends, God. And often there's this domino effect of loss, as Julie Sorrell has found in her research looking at all people exposed to suicide. About a fifth of people have some kind of major life disruption after a suicide, including job loss, divorce, increased substance use. But we find, and I'm excited to talk about today, is really the resilience and the coping, kind of moving through a sense-making period of trying to understand what happened into a meaning-making period of where we are integrating these really difficult experiences into our life, where we're establishing new bonds with our loved ones, and possibly even growing through the experience in a meaning-making process as we get more connected to our spirituality, more connected to the loved ones who survived and so forth. So it's my deep pleasure to now introduce our esteemed international guest, Dr. Sharon McDonald, calling in today from Runsbottom, UK, which is so exciting. I love when we have our international guests. It's a little challenging sometimes with the time zones, but we figured it out. I'm so pleased to bring Sharon to the podcast. First, she's also a sister on a mission with me. She, too, lost a brother in 1990, and we first met at the International Association of Suicide Prevention's conference. I don't know exactly what year. It's been a number of years that we've crossed paths, but we're both part of a special interest group on postvention and grief support, and so we've connected several times in that space. Sharon is the managing directing partner for director for Suicide Bereavement UK, an honorary research fellow at the University of Manchester. She's specialized in suicide bereavement research now for 18 years, which positions her as one of the world's leading authorities in this field. Today we're going to be talking about some of her really great work in moving research to practice. We're going to be talking about her PABS training, postvention, assisting those bereaved by suicide. It's a one-day workshop that's very evidence-based, and so I'm excited to talk about that. We're also going to talk about her incredible work in pulling together an international conference around suicide bereavement. The eighth one will be happening next year, and 9 countries attend, which is exciting to have that many people interested in the science and practice of suicide bereavement support. The reason I asked her to talk today about parental bereavement is because she is one of the world's leading experts on this topic. Her dissertation was Identifying the Experiences of Parents Bereaved by Suicide or of Undetermined Death. And she has worked with some, again, leading world authorities, Professor Nav Kapoor and Barry McGill, on how we could do a better job of supporting people bereaved by suicide. So it's my great pleasure to introduce my guest, Dr. Sharon McDonald. Good morning, Sharon.
Oh, good morning, Sally. It's good afternoon here, actually. It's nearly tea
right.
time.
That's right. Well, hello. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey into this work? How did you come to do what you're doing?
Right. Okay. So, as you said, in 1990, the 29th of December, 1990, I found out, you know, out of the blue, my brother died by suicide. I was 8 months pregnant, and I'm from a large family. I was 30, the eldest of 6 children. My youngest sister was 12. I didn't live at home. I was married, and it's a bit like a grenade, really. The pin's pulled out and thrown into your family. You know, no coping strategies, and you just have to get on with it. 30 years ago now, nearly. It's, you know, it's not good now, but believe me, it was a lot worse then. And so I think when these things happen in your life, you kind of reflect on lots of things, and some things in your life that you put up with, you reflect and you no longer put up with them. But for most people, the pain is so painful and almost life-changing. It's been life-changing for me, but I think I'm quite a positive person. You think, oh, how can you be? But I believe in life. It's like you, Sally. if we look hard enough, you can always find something positive. You know, my brother, it took a very long time, but I believe my brother's, as a it's a fact, a direct result of my brother's death, I do the work that I do now. I wouldn't be doing this. And so when my brother died, so I was 8 months pregnant, so I was fine. Mother Nature kicks in. I went home to my family. I fed everyone because I had to eat because I was pregnant. And then it was a few weeks later after I'd given birth that that's when I wasn't great. So nature's good in some ways, how you can cope, until, you know, when you have to cope. And for a time I wasn't well, and I think, you know, they're normal responses to an abnormal situation, but you don't know that at the time. There is no emotional compass, or there wasn't, for your family. You just have to get on with it. And whilst you've all lost in a family one person, your relationship with them is different, and so your grief responses differ, and sometimes you clash within your family. So in some ways...
I didn't know we shared this experience as well. So I was also a new mom, and my brother also died in December. And so I think there's, for us, like, there was kind of like the circle of life thing to have a new baby in the family, and we just passed that baby Jackson all around. Everybody just wanted to hold him, you know, as kind of this reminder that life goes on. And then also I think having such a traumatic death at the holidays has also been a constant reminder every year that, you know, while there's joy in the world, sure, we were always reminded during the holidays of this loss.
I'd like to cover two things that you've talked about there, because it was a little bit different in my family. And, you know, I'm sharing private stuff here that I've never talked about, you know, and it's, but I think it's important because you'll have listeners that will want to understand some of the things that are going on. So for a period of time, you know, my mum struggled as one in, one out, one in, you know, 6 weeks difference, do you know what I mean? So this lovely notion of a lovely baby passing around, my mum wanted her 30-year-old baby. Do you see what I mean? No matter how old your child is or your child. And then you write about Christmas. My brother died the 29th of December. So on the 30th, where I had family because I'm half Irish, coming over from Ireland. So, you know, you'd have to sorting beds out, food. And it felt like, because it was now building up to New Year's Eve, everyone seemed happy with little hats on and whistles. And I'm going looking for food to feed these people that are coming to my brother's funeral. And at that time, I thought, I will never, till my dying day, ever enjoy Christmas again, ever. And you know what? I do. And now I didn't. And my children, as I had a small family, you know, you really try. And I don't know if you were the same, Sally. It takes a long time to get your head around Christmas, if it's when you've lost someone around that time. But what I'm pleased, what I've managed to achieve, and I didn't know in a way, my children now have grown up, and they love Christmas. So I think, I must have done something right there, you know. And so, but I also want to bring something else up about parents, because this is a massive thing and there's not a lot of research on it, but there will be some of your listeners that will think, oh, God, I identify with that. So when someone dies by suicide, and if they're fairly young, they're adults, but young adults, some have children. And then their grandparents, or their parents, but grandparents to their children, then have to take their children, and they want to take them. But that can also, you can think, oh, that must be lovely. But that is equally, on the flip side, is painful, because the child might look like the person that's died, or the grandparents bringing a child up that's like a child that they've lost. So I think, you know, to think that everybody gets this joyous thing about a baby being around or something, I think we need to be mindful that not all feel like that. It can be a poison chalice for some people, and I think that can be reassuring for people that are hearing this now and feel like that.
Yeah, thank you. So then what happened? How did you find yourself becoming a researcher around this topic? What was that? What was the turning point for you?
Right. So when I was at school, I wasn't interested one bit, didn't want to learn anything, you know, so I kind of left school with no qualifications. But as you know, Sally, and most people, no matter how educated you are or not, the question, why, what if only, and a common grief response is to sort of look for these answers. The reality is we'll never know the answers because the person that can answer them is not here, but it doesn't matter. We're on a mission. And part of my mission, which has happened completely by accident, but this is, I think, the positive bit that I was saying before about something negative. As I said, I had no qualifications. I educated myself. I did a degree. I did a PhD. And so now I kind of now are armed. I wear two hats. I'm a bereaved person. I know that pain. I know how isolated people are. But now I've got the skills to do something with that. And I think, I don't know if you agree with me here, Sally, because I know what you're like and the passion you've got. It's like nothing else. You know, when you put that, if you work through your own grief and then you can, you know, you've got the skills, you know, you can move mountains and miracles take a little bit longer to sort out, but we have an energy and a passion that most people don't have. I don't know if you feel like that.
Yes, I always say that it's often, historically, it's been lost survivors, people bereaved by suicide, that I say kind of we stand there holding the flag no matter what else is happening. We march forward whether or not we have funding, whether or not we have support in our community, because we're so committed to, you know, our loved one didn't die in vain. So the passion and the commitment, I do think, is there when you have this lived experience piece often. So thank you. Yes, I love how you say, you know, we're on a mission to find answers and we can move mountains. Because I do think it's been a lot of lost survivor energy that has moved suicide prevention and grief support forward.
Absolutely. And the reality is, and I don't know if you agree with this, you know, not all of us are strong and get up. Some people never sort of get through that grief for whatever reason, and there's not a lot of us. There's getting more and more, you know, and so once we dust ourselves down and get up, we're getting up for all those that are struggling, and so we're very mindful of that. And later on in this interview, I'd like to talk about the survey that I've done, because that is a classic example, and I'll explain later about that.
Yeah, well, we can transition now. Let's talk a little bit about your research. Let's talk about kind of what your dissertation. Let's start there, because that's the main topic of the conversation, and kind of how you got into that work and what were some of your findings.
Right. So as a direct result of educating myself, I did a psychology degree, and my dissertation for my first degree, I did a dissertation on parental suicide bereavement. And the reason why I chose these people, there was no one in this country, you know, I was like, just nobody, because this was not of interest. Suicide, didn't even realise it was suicide prevention. And the reason why I chose parents, or to do research with parents in my dissertation, was I thought, you know, if parents struggle to cope, you know, but if a young person dies by suicide, because my first study looked at people at the age of 35 and under, if one young person dies by suicide, this is in the UK now, the average family has 2.2 children. So if one dies, you've got another child or young person in that family struggling to cope. We know parents struggle. So I theorise that if we could look at the vulnerability and needs of parents, we could empower them to look after their children. That was a theory anyway. So my PhD, what I found was, you know, because people say, oh, people bereaved by suicide can't seek help and the shame. Well, I would challenge that. This is the UK anyway. Some might not be able to, but some try, and a lot try, and they find they can't get into the system. So this is, we have what we call the National Health Service. I don't know what it's like, I don't know what it's similar to in the US. You're a bit different, your health service, aren't you? We receive healthcare at the point of need. And so mm-hmm. these people would go to the doctor, the GP, and there's nowhere to signpost them. There's no national support thing. So what the and this is still the case, that even though the majority of people fit within the remit of psychiatric services, they can't get them into secondary care, and they're signposting them to the voluntary sector, which, you know, to be fair, there's some excellent work going out there, but they don't get funded. And I don't know, it's like in the US, money's very tight over here now, so they're living hand to mouth on a 6-monthly basis, some of them, whether they can survive another year looking after people. And so that's an issue. But what we know, this is across internationally, really, there's research to say that health professionals are anxious and uncertain what to say to people bereaved by suicide, parents. And within the UK, we'll have like a GP practice. And if they lose a young person to suicide, what is quite unique for GPs, the family's coming in next. So they'll lose one person, and then these people seek help. So what actually happens, the GPs, one, they're devastated often that they've lost a patient. Well, then within 24 hours, 48 hours, you've got the family coming in. So this element, and a lot of health professionals don't realise that they have the same grief responses as the parents or the families. They feel shame, guilt, fear of being blamed, fear of being sued, though that's a bit different for clinicians. But some clinicians, because I know you're a clinician, Sally, you can get attached to your patients and can mm-hmm. and experience real loss. Not just the fear of being sued. And so when my PhD, what we realised, you know, when I was interviewing the parents, and then they were telling me what people were saying to them. So, like, I'll give you an example. One went in and a child, because it's for a parent. It doesn't matter how old they are, they're always your child. I've got a 30-year-old child. But when they went in with the, you know, they were under 35, and then a GP would say, because she suffered from schizophrenia, and say, oh, well, schizophrenics tend to do that. Now, when you hear that, you think, oh, that's terrible. But, you know, and then another one will say, well, and this is another example, remember, as clear as anything, oh, suicide's on the increase in the Northwest. Now, when you hear that, you think, how cruel is that? But the reality is, you know, they don't know what to say, and if you stand back, mm-hmm. take the emotion out of it, they're trying to reassure them that it's a schizophrenia mm-hmm. or it's mm-hmm. you know, it's a problem in this area, but they haven't got the vocabulary or the words, and definitely not got the training. And I would argue that most people, every single person, and yourself included and myself, in some situations, I'm not talking about suicide, I'm in life, sometimes when we don't know what to say, we blurt things out and we think, oh, I just said that. And this is, they're not cruel, these clinicians. They just don't know what to say and say the wrong thing. And it's not acceptable. It's a training issue. But I think that's more forgivable than thinking that they're cruel. Do you see what I mean? I think
that makes
understandable.
People are doing the best they can with the tools they have. And we've been conditioned to be very uncomfortable when we don't know what we're doing, are very uncomfortable with silence. And so we'll fill it in with whatever's coming to mind. And sometimes that's not the best, but it's often well-intentioned. So did this study then lead you into PAVS?
So what happened then, what I found was the parents were able to seek help, but they were getting these inappropriate responses. You know, so I thought, you know what, this study is potentially biased because it's only asking parents. We need to know what's going on for health professionals. So I subsequently got more funding to develop training. So it was to identify the experiences and perceived needs of parents bereaved by suicide, a person up to about 40, and then the experiences and perceived needs, this is emotional training, everything, of the professionals that come into contact with the parent to care for them. So if you can visualise, we managed to identify a parent different ways through self-help groups, advertising, and we would ask them the vulnerability and needs, and with their permission, they would tell us who their GP, which GP we should contact, and then we would go to them and ask them the vulnerability needs. What do you need? What was difficult about caring for that parent? What do you need in place? And then, if they were referred to, that parent was referred to mental health services, we would then go back and ask them. But what happened, so what we've learned, what reaffirmed in the second study, parents were asking for help, and the GPs were confirming this because they were saying it. But the problem was the GP said they couldn't get them into secondary services. So this study was unique because we wanted a holistic picture, because if you're going to change anything, you have to understand all perspectives. Well, that's my view anyway. But we couldn't get any mental health professionals to match with the parents because none of them got into the system, which is frustrating, but a major finding in itself. And we also intended to interview A&E staff, if any of them had died in A&E. But what we've learned, and it's probably the same in the US, you know, a lot of people die in the home. So the first health professional that comes in contact with them is the ambulance staff.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, what we learned was we were developing training, and we couldn't develop training for ambulance staff because they're dealing with trauma. So we developed evidence-based, the first of its kind internationally, because it's informed by a 3-year study. I got a Winston Churchill Travel Fellowship, went to Australia and New Zealand, and based on the interviews from the parents, the GPs, we've developed this training. And so I'm honestly really, really proud of it. It's. I think as researchers, and, you know, I am a researcher, but I think a criticism of researchers, they'll do research, they'll publish, probably in a journal that most people can't read if they don't subscribe to it, and then that's it.
That's
but
right.
What I'm particularly proud of is that I've done research, developed training, and then I'm now delivering it. So it hasn't stopped at the publication bit. Do you see what I mean? Because I think
so important. It's such a huge issue with academia that the findings, all the work that goes behind that, rarely gets translated into something meaningful in the world because of exactly what you said, accessibility to that knowledge, and then the effort to then, you know, apply it. So I'm so glad that you're doing this work. Can you tell us more specifically what happens in the training? And is it just for GPs or other professionals coming into contact with the family, like coroners, funeral home folks,
responders? So this is the funny thing. We was going to do a pilot training. We were doing pilot workshops. So there was doing 4 pilot workshops, and 20 people can come on this. It's a one-day interactive workshop. It was originally designed, I would say, it's predominantly biased to GPs and mental health professionals. So when we started promoting this, the people could come for free, but in reality, nothing in life is free. They had to fill in a 7-page evaluation form. And then when we advertised it, every man and his dog wanted to come on it. And we had at one point, we stopped it because we had 58 wanting to come on it. It was free. But anyway.
Well, that's very exciting to have that demand.
Well, it is.
You're doing some really important things over there.
Yeah, so, but what was interesting, so you can imagine now, I've got this training, I want to demonstrate how good it is, but ethically, you know, I'm getting funeral directors, coroners, priests, occupational health, social work, all wanting to come on it, and I thought, oh, what do I do here? So part of me, as a researcher, you'd think, no, just let GPs come on this, you know, that's going to skew the results, and I thought, no, can't do that. And, but sometimes when we do things by accident, it's the best thing. So morally, I felt, you know, let whoever wants to come, and let's just see what happens. So 99% of people that have been on it would recommend it. And bearing in mind, it's designed for GPs. So you've got coroner's office. We haven't done anything about coroners, but they loved it. It just needs tweaking a little bit. But I want to share something which I think is really important, and we're due to publish a paper on this. So the first workshop, so what we do is we train them, but I feel very strongly about this. We need to look after professionals, and they, a lot of them, I don't know if it's the same in the US, they're conditioned almost not to look after themselves, or they're not,
yes.
You know, mm-hmm. Some get it, nurses, but then GPs, psychiatrists don't. How can that be right? So part of our training, after speaking to doing the research, we focus on self-care as well, which
that's
is
great.
Yeah.
And
so Bonnie McGale,
barely gotten. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, I was just saying,
hello?
You know, sometimes it might be the first time that they've received that message of self-care, that you know, given permission to take care of themselves, and they're going to be better providers when they do that. So I'm so grateful for this work. You were saying Barry McGale?
Oh, yeah. So Barry delivers it. And what we do, so the train, and we always have two trainers, and I'm there as well. So we have three. So I'm kind of looking after them as well. So they have three. Because what we found in the pilot phase, so we create this nurturing place. As long as you say permission, it's not therapy, but it's therapeutic, because like you say, some never get this opportunity. But I would argue trainers have to be able to, if you create this kind of special training, you have to be able to deal with what rises up as well, because they don't realise. So in the first workshop, because we're creating this place where they can talk a bit more openly, we thought, God, there's loads of these people that are bereaved. It seems like they started. So we started evaluating that, and this is a big shock to us. And in my ignorance, I hadn't even thought of this. On the pilot phase, 33% of professionals attending are bereaved by suicide, and 88% have said they've been profoundly affected. Not that they've just lost a patient, they're very, very upset. So what we've learned with this training, anyone can deliver training, but what we've got to be mindful of, who's in that room, who's attracted to this kind of training, and what's in place when they come. And I think this is something, probably in the US as well, that's not really considered about the vulnerability of professionals.
Yes, I always, in the beginning, I do a lot of training with mental health providers to, you know, just think about improving their skills around suicide intervention and grief support. And I always acknowledge in the beginning of my trainings that there are many people walking in the room with all types of personal experiences with suicide, their own suicide attempts, their own suicide loss, and their caregiving for family members and friends that are also informing their practice and influencing their practice. And we have to talk about that and acknowledge that if we're going to be doing our best work. We can't pretend that these things don't happen to the professionals as well. So thank you so much for acknowledging that and giving people space to heal from that in the context of them also learning better skills to serve the people that they're trying to help. Let's go back to parents. So in all of this research, what are some of your insights on things parents need to move through this grief, to make meaning and grow from it? How are you seeing parents healing? What does that process look like?
Well, for a lot of parents, and you covered it brilliantly at the beginning, you know, it's a challenge to their assumptive world and the identity as a parent, and many of them feel guilt, shame, blamed, the order of a child dying before a parent. It just challenges so many aspects of the world. But I think the key thing for these parents is, you know, they feel helpless and hopeless, you know, and I think, you know, if clinicians were educated on how to respond to these people, it would help reduce the anxiety. They need a proactive response to these parents, which I don't know, does that happen in the U.S.?
So, yes, we have a wonderful program, the LOSS program, again, founded by Frank Campbell, who's like the father of all things suicide grief related in the U.S. And he also talks about, you know, that we just expect people bereaved by suicide, you know, to stumble upon the resources, right, in their worst point of their life, you know, where they're very compromised. We expect them to find the resources by foraging in the dark. And he said, that's ridiculous. Instead, let's reach out and let's have our systems of care ready and reaching and bringing people in and welcoming people into support rather than expecting them to find us. And so I can't say it's a universal thing that we do, but his efforts certainly have got some national momentum where we're building these loss teams where first responders are paired with a person who has been bereaved by suicide and who is down the road in their grief journey. And together they go on site for death notification of families. And, of course, it's always chaotic. But often the families remember the support person of the peer, the person who said, you know what, I've been there and I'll walk with you through this. And so, yes, we're getting better at the proactive piece. We have a long way to go, but it is where we're headed.
Yeah. Well, I think we're actually starting. We've got an organization in the UK called If You Care Share. And I went with Shirley Smith. We came to the Loss Conference in Phoenix, and she's now piloting a Loss team here. So this is massive to us. You know, it's kind of, you know, groundbreaking. So you're doing amazing work over there. But, you know, sometimes, like you say, you've got the Loss teams, but is there a lot of lost teams in the U.S.? Or we have what you have a zip code, we have a postcode. Here, it depends where you live, what you get. Oh, that's morally wrong. I think, you know,
yes,
there should be something standardized, you know, whether it's cancer, you know, whatever it is, it should be fair right across the ground, not just what zip code or postcode you're in. But with regards to the lost team and going out there, these parents that I've interviewed, they know health professionals are anxious meeting them. They know when they go in that, or they feel that they want them, when they have a consultation, that they're wanting them out as soon as they're coming in. And then when I've interviewed the health professionals, it's true. And it's not because they don't care. They're just frightened of dealing with these people. So I would argue, you know, even if you don't know what to say, just try to be there. And there's a saying, I can't remember who said it, and it's something about, you know, they might not remember what you say, but they will remember how you made them feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so being a bit nervous is okay, but just being there as a human being to another, sometimes that is enough. Or will do, and that sounds really simple, but sometimes simple things are the most effective, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the things, again, I try to help my providers think about is, you know, before you go into this meeting, just take a deep breath and ground yourself and try to touch a place inside yourself of gratitude, of, you know, you have an honor and a privilege today to walk alongside someone in their darkest moment, and that's an honor. And if you can touch that gratitude and that calmness, we're mirroring creatures. And so people will find that in themselves. They'll feel more safe and more reassured by you if you can touch upon that sense of honor and gratitude and connection. Because you're right, what comes out of our mouth, sometimes we don't remember, and it's often imperfect. It really is more about showing up and creating space and really just listening to people's stories, especially in the beginning, letting people share, you know, speaking the name of the child and acknowledging the significance. I think it's a powerful thing that providers can do. You're not going to fix it with anything you say.
I totally, that's lovely what you've actually said, but I think there's one thing, if there was one thing I would say, I don't know if it's the same in the US, but it is here. I mean, you go back in history, if someone tried to take their own life and survived, they were killed, and then time moved on, but then they put them in prison. You know, 1961 in the UK, it stopped being a crime. But people still say commit suicide. That's devastating for these people. And I think if nothing else, they learn the vocabulary. If even if they don't know the behavioural responses, And I don't know if it's the same in the US. Does that offend people in the US? It does in the UK, using the word commit suicide.
Yes, is we talk about this often. Yeah, the importance of language and how we are expressing these things matters greatly. And I think there's an increasing awareness. I'm seeing a lot more articles coming out. I'm noticing that our media is not using the phrase commit suicide anymore. But it is the general way that people have been taught to say it since, you know, as soon as they learned it was a phenomenon. So it takes people a little bit to work the language out of their vocabulary. And so I'm also patient with people who are trying. You know, sometimes they just say it because it's the way they've always said it. But I'm noticing more and more that people are trying to catch themselves and say, wait a minute, let me try that again. You know, they died of suicide. And I said, you know, thank you. Thank you for working with us to try to shift how we're thinking about it through the language of the words that we choose.
Hmm.
Yeah. So other things that we can do to support parents, or that parents can do in their own process of working through the mourning and the grief.
Yeah, I think with regards to parents, because this was something, because I heard you before saying that you'd got children when you was, you know, they were young children. And I think this is another thing so I'm thinking of parents that have got other young children, they, mm-hmm. you know, they need to be, how can I put it, one minute my brother was there, then the next he wasn't, and then immediately you have to tell your family. And if you've got young children, we haven't even got the vocabulary or the knowledge what to say. No one tells us, and then people think, oh, I'll say it's an accident, and then the lies start, and then they work it out later. My daughter found out later, and I feel terrible about that, but I didn't know. Some children find out in the playground, you know. So I think professionals immediately need to guide them. When they tell them, they need to give them something, because telling children doesn't wait. They have to deal. If it's a father, they have to say why daddy's not come home. And so I feel very strongly. But I would really recommend, I know we're different countries, but the world is a smaller place now with the internet, and I would recommend your listeners to have a go on Winston's Wish website.
Mm.
Superb, superb. They what they do there, you might have something. I think you've got the Dougie Centre, have you? I don't know. But
yeah, the Dougie Centre.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
they have. But we have clinicians on that. This is a charity, and they will take calls from families. They support families and children, and they will give advice, but for professionals. But they have some amazing things that you can order, books and memory things. You know, I would really recommend they look on there. They might find some things that, you know, cost a bit more in postage, but there might be something there that they really like that'll help them.
That's great, and it's so important. You're absolutely right. You know, when people have, especially young children that developmentally don't really fully understand death yet, let alone suicide. I think people in their fear and in their desire to protect children react sometimes in ways that just make it more complicated later. My kiddos, my oldest was 6, my middle boy was 4, and Jackson was just 3 months, and they were in the car with me when I learned the news of Carson's death. And so while I don't know that I would have done anything different, there was no escaping the fact that we're going to have this conversation when they're very little. And I really like what the Dougie Center and also Judy's House is another one here in the United States that helps kids, and the Moyer Foundation. They've worked really hard on how to help young people, very young people, come to grips with a family member's suicide. And they just always talk about the importance of, you know, meeting kids where they're at, answering the questions that they ask with a very concrete, simple, honest answer, and that over time, you know, they will ask more in-depth questions as they need to know. And so that's a really good founding principle, I think, for parents who are trying to navigate this. You don't have to give them all the details at the first pass. Sometimes they just want to know, as you said, are we ever going to see them again? And so you answer that question. And then maybe years later they'll say, well, what happened to them? And you can answer that in a very simple, you know, honest, concrete way. And just have the conversation evolve over time as the child is ready. So that work, I'm so glad you're also training the providers around this, because sometimes they'll be the ones to help coach the parents please don't lie.
Yes.
Because when you lie, then there's all this other, you know, eventually kids find out, they do. And then they have to go back and grieve the whole thing again. And then there's also this mistrust. My people who were supposed to protect me didn't tell me the truth, and
yeah.
I find that confusing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a really good piece. Anything else you want to say for the parents who are supporting, especially young children, through this process?
No, I think that's kind of, I mean, there's lots of things, but I think what your listeners might be interested in the survey that I'm doing, because parents are filling that in. I don't know if I would be allowed to tell you a little bit about that?
I would love that. Thank you.
Right. So this is about, you know, passion or stupidity. I'm not sure which it is yet, and I'll let you know in a couple of years. So in the UK, we have a suicide prevention strategy that looks very nice and got lots of bullet points of what we're going to do. And one of them is, there's six or seven now key objectives, provide better information and support to those bereaved or affected by suicide. So this is the first time now the word affected, my interpretation of that, we're now thinking about people like yourself as a professional. So, you know, put us all together. And that's all well and good, but we don't know what these people need. We have to rely on other countries like the US and Australia. And so I thought, right, we need to do research. I was at the university for 16 years. It's a government priority. I'm a researcher. That's my job. I'm not a business person. And there's no government funding to do research. It's a government priority. Well, I can't work that one out. But anyway, set my own business up. That's the only way I could continue doing suicide bereavement research, which I wasn't very happy about. But that's the difference. when we feel so strongly about something, I'm not sure if it's brave or stupid. We'll make calculated risk, and that was setting up a business. So anyway, we're doing a study. It's in collaborate. It's been hosted at the University of Manchester, and an organisation that has 35 other organisations in it. No funding, so we're doing it for free. This would probably cost about £350,000 to do, easy. So, but I kind of like having the moral high ground, because it's amazing. I think the government are going to so wish they've paid for this, because I'm going to be on that moral high ground. So we started doing it. It's for anyone now, anyone who considers themselves to be bereaved or affected. So it's for bereaved families, it's for a psychiatrist, it's for whoever, and you're anonymous. So there's 72 questions, and We put it out there. I launched it at my conference where 400 people attend, and in 11 months we've had 7,700 people fill it in.
Wow, so it's a huge data set. Go, Sharon, go.
Yeah. So what's lovely about it? So I'm on Twitter and I do Twitter. And when I first started doing it, and I know I'm not a typical researcher, but in some ways I think that's my strength, because I don't seem the brightest, but, you know, it disarms people. And so at my conference, it started off, and I didn't do it the typical way. I just said, look, I know you lot care about this. I have a link. Will you share it? And let's come back next year and see how we go on. And on Twitter, every day I would thank people for doing it. And every day someone filled it in, apart from Christmas Day, which I was happy about. And the people on Twitter, because I know you're on Twitter, Sally.
Yeah, I'll send some stuff out.
I call them Team UK. I report every day and say, thank you, Team UK, or thank you for so many. And then I'd say things like, oh, I need some journalists to promote this. Did find me journalists. And then there's this famous football in the UK, and I said, come on, you men, this is rubbish. You know, there's only 18% of men filling this in. If you're not careful, you're going to end up having a service that women want. And this famous person said to me, Sharon, take over my Twitter account, and that'll get you some men. So he gave me his password.
Nice.
I got 400 men in 24 hours.
So you're brilliant. You're brilliant. That's fantastic.
Well, I don't know. But this is going to be the researchers internationally are looking at this, because they're a bit shocked that we've got, which I am as well. But the findings, let me tell you, they're shocking. And so whilst we all know it's bad, it's a lot worse than that, but it will be powerful because it's research.
How long is the survey going to be open for?
It's closed now, and we're launching the reports at my conference next year, the 25th
of
September.
Look forward to that. Yeah, we'll look forward to that. All right, well, wonderful. Let me go through some of the themes of our conversation and kind of hit some highlights as a wrap-up, and then I'll come back to you for some final thoughts you have, some takeaway points perhaps for parents in particular and the providers on what to do moving forward. So we started off our conversation. We talked about, I shared some information about traumatic grief and that push-pull, that experience of both longing to reminisce and continue the bonds with the person who has died, as well as this experience of trauma that often leads people to want to avoid the memories, avoid the experience. We talked about the shattered assumptions of trauma and how that affects people's world sense of safety and their own core sense of worth in their process of trying to make sense out of the thing that doesn't make sense and then moving into a place of making meaning and integrating this horrific experience into the narrative of their life. We talked about your brother and our shared experience of losing a sibling to suicide and your powerful image of having a grenade pin pulled out and thrown into the family. That is so visceral. And I used the analogy of a tsunami because my brother died right around the time of the Asian tsunami. And I felt like that was a really powerful analogy for what we had gone through. And then, you know, for some, the experience of moving through that trauma and finding kind of the calling of our lives and being on a mission, as you said, to move mountains and find answers. We talked about your dissertation around parent suicide bereavement. And the real call that I feel from you coming forward is we need to do better. We need to do a better job of showing up for families, parents in particular, with the best response we can muster from the first moment, from the first responders to the coroners to the funeral directors to the healthcare providers to the mental health service folks. We can do better in having them prepared, and we can do a better job in acknowledging that all of these people are also fellow grievers and also traumatized by these experiences, and to help say that out loud and help acknowledge that they too feel the shame and the blame and the sadness and the anxiety and all of these emotions. Even while they have their professional titles, they are also human and they're also experiencing this. We talked about the real important need for parents whose worlds are often completely upended. As you said, the order of life is disrupted. This is not how things are supposed to go. Parents are not supposed to bury their children, and how this leads to this incredible loop of hopelessness that we can do more proactive work to show up and be compassionate for people, especially in the first stages, but a long time sometimes, because this is for many people. I've seen parents who've lost children a decade later still working on trying to find some kind of new normal, and also experiencing all kinds of, you know, what my friend Scott Chisholm calls collateral damage, job loss, divorce, bankruptcy, all of these other dominoes start to fall sometimes after a suicide loss. We talked about the vocabulary and how important it is. I say worlds make words and words make worlds. And so we have to be very cognizant of the language that we're using and how that shapes people's experience and presumptions about what's happening. And so moving away, for example, from the phrase committed suicide into just the guide of suicide is one important step that people can take. And then we talked about the parents who are now raising surviving siblings. Sometimes they're very young, and how that's a very complicated and overwhelming experience for parents to figure out how to do that. And so we gave a couple of suggestions on help guiding them and some resources. Winston Swish, we'll definitely put that in the show notes. Thank you for offering that. I wasn't aware of that one, so I'm always looking for new resources, as well as the Dougie Center and Judy's House. And then so exciting to hear about your new survey. And this is going to be tremendous. I can't wait for the report to come out. for the bad news of how things are not going well for the bereaved, but also for the good news in the energy and hopefully funding that this study will help generate so that we can do a better job to support all of those impacted by suicide. So quite a round of things that we chatted about, Sarah, thank you so much for coming today. Do you have some final takeaways for our listeners?
Well, you've done brilliant there. You've summed it all up. It's really good. I think there's one more document that I think they would like to look at. Help is at hand, if they Google that. And that is, I was involved in it, but the government gave it to people bereaved by suicide to write it for people bereaved by suicide, and it's very well received in this country, and you can download it, and I would recommend that book.
Great, thank you.
I would say that your health professionals need to have a proactive response. They need to if they visit the families, have the resources, take the resources to these people. And I would say ultimately, this survey that I'm doing, because it's of an international interest, while 7,700 people have filled it in, that, as you would imagine, there's a lot of pain in there, but there's a lot of love. But more than that, more than any of those two, there's a lot of hope, and the hope that this, sharing the vulnerabilities, we ask questions that people wouldn't dare ask, or clinicians, but that half a team are bereaved by suicide, so we know. And I think this, you know, hope is bigger than the other two put together. And for some people, this survey, that's probably the first time they've had hope for a very long time. Do you know what I mean? And I think whilst we look at the negatives, I think to survive almost, we need to look at where the light is and where there's hope. And that's how I cope, and it works for me.
Oh, what a wonderful and beautiful way to sum this up, and also to acknowledge sometimes research in and of itself is an intervention. It's a therapeutic process for the research participants sometimes, and again, from that meaning-making perspective to participate. So, yes, we acknowledge there's suffering and there's pain, and there's also tremendous hope and love. Beautiful. Thank you. Well, it's been such a privilege to have you on the show. I love hearing you across the pond and connecting this way and connecting you to our listeners around the world. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about your work and your resources?
Yes, yeah, so it's suicidebereavementuk.com. If they're on Twitter, it would be at SJMCDONN.
Great. So please connect with Dr. McDonald and get her research, learn from her program. She has an amazing conference every year, bringing in international people to pull together and share their thoughts and share their thought leadership and their experiences. If you love this podcast as much as I did, I hope that you subscribe to our iTunes channel. You can also find us on Blog Talk Radio and on my website, SallySpencerThomas.com. Please subscribe, leave a rating and review. It helps people find us through the algorithms of iTunes. And it also gives me some really important feedback on topics you want to hear about, how we're doing, and how to improve this as we go forward. Also, please sign up for my newsletter. It comes up monthly. I also do a Twitter chat each month. I'm part of United Survivors International, and we have a webinar each month, so lots of good content, good resources, and interaction with our international experts all the time. So in closing, open your heart, challenge your thinking, take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.
It's maybe the night that my dreams might let me know. All the stars are closer. All the stars are closer.
Tell me what you gonna do to me. Confrontation ain't nothing new to me. You could bring a bullet, bring a sword, bring a morgue, but you can't bring the truth to me.
Alexa, play Kendrick Lamar and SZA.
Okay.
With Amazon Music, a voice is all you need. Get tens of millions of songs. Download the Amazon Music app today.